I thought I'd share some thoughts that are simply, I've entitled, Lessons from Disabilities. The first lesson that I'm struck with comes from Leviticus chapter 19, verse 14. Do not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block in front of the blind, but fear your God. I am the Lord. That very early on, what we find is God has a special concern for people with disabilities. And he is very much aware of the way in which sometimes those of us who may not have such visible disabilities can be really mean. And so he talks about, well, who would curse the deaf? So you shout in their ears, but they can't hear you. They don't know they're being cursed. Who would put something in the path of somebody who's blind that would make them trip? You do that, they trip, and everybody else falls into laughter. And you can think about that. Maybe you haven't done those specific ones, but you can think about the jokes. You can think about the slurs that are so easily made regarding people with disabilities. Just the general unkindness. I'm basically going to tell a few stories today. I remember once speaking up at Edinburgh University. I was speaking at an inter-varsity group, and there was a student who came in quite late and obviously had some physical limitations and disabilities. But he managed to come in and he managed to sit down and was there during the presentation. But I noticed when I was finished speaking that there was something wrong with his jacket. Somehow the zipper was stuck, and he was trying to get it back on, and it was about halfway on and halfway off, and obviously not going anywhere. And I was talking with another student, and out of the corner of my eye, I'm watching this student, and I finally said to the other student, don't you think maybe we ought to help him? And everybody else who could see it basically ignored it, rather than saying, oh, well, obviously he has the problem. And all you have to say, see, you don't have to sort of be demeaning, say, could I give you a hand? Could I help you? Now, people who have disabilities don't want to be pitied, but sometimes they need some help. Most of you haven't been around long enough to remember when I had a motorcycle accident and broke my collarbone and six ribs and literally had to be wheeled to building so I didn't use all my energy up just trying to get there. And then 9 years ago, I had rotator cuff surgery, having a fall, and it took months to get it diagnosed. The surgery took 45 minutes, and on the way home, I was feeling great. And then the meds wore off. And when the meds wore off, I literally went an entire semester not being able to write on the board. I went an entire semester with my arm in a sling, remembering things like, oh, that didn't hurt so much when I woke up this morning. And literally trying to get around, and people, a number of people, were just very helpful. One of the custodians said I was milking it, so I'd go through the lunch line, always grab somebody who'd come and carry my tray for me. He thought I did it long before I needed to have it keep on going. But I remember going to lunch one day, and the problem with the rotator cuff surgery, you really can't move it very much. And I managed to get a plate. It was a faculty lunch, and I sat down with the plate in front of me. And one of my colleagues, the former registrar, looked and said, would you like me to cut your meat for you? And I went, oh, no. And then I discovered that I couldn't cut my meat. And I quietly pushed the plate across the table, and without saying anything, she nicely cut all the meat for me and quietly pushed it back across the table for me so that I could eat. And I was very grateful. See, I was, oh, I can do this, and then I couldn't. And she didn't say, well, let me cut that for you. She just very nice. See, so part of my challenge is when God talks about disabilities, he talks about concern and compassion being helpful. We've tried to do a number of things to get ourselves up to code. You need to know when I had particularly the rotator cuff surgery, I went to the vice president of business affairs and said, let me show you the doors that don't work very well. And some of them, particularly at the science and engineering building, there was a wonderful button. I said, now watch this. I walked up, I pressed the button, and the outer door opened. And he said, so what's the problem? I said, what about the inner door? There was no button on the inner door. So I couldn't get in unless somebody else. And you all know that if you're in Northwood, even with the buttons, those doors are really heavy, right? So have pity on us who have the disability of old age. Right? Just kind of, if you see me, I will not be upset if you offer to open the door for me. Right? So that's just part of it is awareness. It's sensitivity. It's kindness. But I want to tell you some stories about people I've known. The first person I want to talk about is a woman who's now gone to be with the Lord, Betty McBee. Betty had muscular dystrophy, and it had come to her when she was fairly young. And it was when the muscular dystrophy is a progressive disease, and it particularly impacts muscles of the face. And Betty's problem was she had some speech difficulties. And I remember that people made fun of her. She told the story of one time going into the principal's office, because it was teacher center, and the principal said, "What's your name?" And all she goes, "Me." And he said, "Well, if you can't say your name, I will not give you what you're asking for." And she could not say it. And her father was a pastor. And Betty would often go with him on pastoral visitations. Her father would be inside. And she told me the story of sitting in the car, looking in the mirror, and spending hours making her face work so she could say, "Betty McBee." And towards the end of her life, she had quite a speaking ministry. And somebody told her, "Betty, if you hadn't practiced when you were 5, you would not be able to do that." But as the years went on, Betty's limitations increased. So she needed to be in a wheelchair. And then she got early on, this is 20 plus years ago, one of the first little electric scooters. The thing was heavy and you had to have a special lift to get it in and out. And the numbers. Our church had to learn, okay, how do we make accommodations for Betty? We could get her in up the upstairs. We had to design ramps and things to help get her in. Sometimes we'd make her nervous. We'd put her in a wheelchair and 4 of us would lift her and carry her in. And we thought she was very safe. That was not how Betty was feeling. I went to a conference with Betty at one point, and I basically was her assistant and would go off and get lunch for us, make sure she got in, etc. She was very mobile once she was in a room, once she was set, there were never things she couldn't do. But after working with Betty, after helping Betty, and being helped by Betty, I made a serious, serious mistake. I was preaching through the book of Acts, and I got to the place where a crippled man is healed. And Chuck Swindoll had this great title called "A Cripple Dances in Church." So I used that title, and Betty was appalled. And she was angry. And she was virtually in tears when she said, "Do you not realize what you just did?" She said, "You define that person by his disability." That was one of the lessons, and I still have to be careful. He's not a cripple. He is a crippled man. A person with a disability is, first of all, a person. They are not defined by the disability. But you have to be careful because our society tends to do that. We have to watch ourselves all the time. So that was a huge lesson for me to learn from Betty. And then Betty had one other thing. Betty's famous line was, "All of us have disabilities. Some of ours are just more visible." See, you and I may be able to hide some of our disabilities. Other people's disabilities are more pronounced, and sometimes there's a little bit of that superiority complex that comes through. It's like, "Well, I'm not like that." And what we have to come back to is God has created us in His own image. The Psalm 139, which talks about people being fearfully and wonderfully made, doesn't apply to people without disabilities. It applies to everybody. They've all been created. Gabe Lyons, who was here a few years ago, who's written a number of books, had a child born with Down syndrome. And he and his wife discovered that something like 75% of the unborn children diagnosed with Down syndrome will be aborted. See, that's the way our country is now dealing with disabilities. If you have anything that might be a difficulty after a child is born, well, let's just get rid of it. That's the culture that we're living in. How do we speak against that? How do we act against that? So Gabe Lyons and his wife head up a foundation for people who have, they try to get to them when they get the diagnosis and say, "Look, let us tell you what this is like. Here's some of the realities, but here's some of the joys." Rather than simply putting them to death, rather than getting rid of them because they're inconvenient. The second story involves my wife. My wife, Nancy, some of you will remember, was the director of the Access Office for a number of years until retiring in May. And I remember when Nancy first took over that position and I was teaching in the Bible department, we had a student that we both knew. We knew him because of parents and grandparents, etc. And he was in our house one time, and Nancy had been explaining to me that this particular student was dyslexic. By the way, that was one of the things that you would have heard from Nelson Lauber. Being dyslexic and managing to cope without ever letting people know that he was dyslexic. But this particular student was dyslexic. He was very bright, but he was dyslexic. And at the point at which he was at our house for dinner one time, he had a D in Bible. And I thought, that's really interesting. He couldn't read computer manuals very well because of his dyslexia, but is a computer genius. He could figure it out. As a matter of fact, heads up an IT department in a company in Pittsburgh now, because he is such a genius with computers. And during the conversation, I said to him, so if you took the Bible test on a computer, would you do better? He said, probably. Now, this is 20 years ago, and we weren't very computerized yet. The Bible department had one of the first computers. It was a Mac. All of our Bible tests were on Mac. And if he was going to take the Bible test, he was going to have to take it on a PC. And my wife said, don't worry, he also suffers from a little bit of short-term memory loss. So if you let him take the Bible test off the Mac and put it on the PC, it'll be okay. So he did that. And he started taking his Bible test on the PC. And went from a D to a B. And all we did was change the way in which he took the test. We quit testing, and we started testing material. And again, if you haven't done this, if you have a diagnosed learning disability, or you think you have a problem, please go to the Access Office. The Access Office is your advocate as students to make sure you get whatever accommodations are needed. And sometimes professors don't realize it. And we not only saw it with that student, we began to see other students who, if they had to take an essay, they'd do all the multiple choice, everything else, but they would do the essay on the computer, and suddenly life became a whole lot easier. We had to discover that. It wasn't something that came naturally to us. Perhaps my wife's greatest satisfaction was seeing Josie Badger, who is speaking tomorrow night, and you really should go hear her, seeing Josie Badger graduate. Josie has a number of disabilities, who made her way through college with assistance, with accommodation, and with an aid dog. Right? She had this wonderful dog, went everywhere with her, and we made a note that, as a matter of fact, I think one of the few times, if ever, in history, we not only gave Josie a diploma, we gave her dog a certificate for completing 4 years of classroom attendance. And Ken Carson, the provost, in awarding the certificate to the dog, said, this dog has probably sat in more classes than some of our students. Okay. Now, I want to tell you a biblical story. I'm going to ask the guys to put the passage up. It's a passage from 2 Samuel, and it's about a man named Mephibosheth. Say that 10 times. Right? And David said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him the David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. And the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. The king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Maker, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Maker, the son of Ammiel, at Lo Debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth? And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always. And he paid homage and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I? Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson, and you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him, shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. That it? Okay, good. Here's what happens. I'm taking you back into the Old Testament. Mephibosheth is a son of Jonathan. You may recall from Old Testament survey that Saul is the first king of Israel. Saul looks good at the beginning, but as he goes on, Saul becomes more and more arrogant, does not obey God, usurps to himself the role of a priest at a particular point, And so begins to serve himself instead of God. And God says, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you and give it to somebody else. And so David is secretly anointed to be the next king. But it will be some time before David actually attains the throne. And Saul hates David because Saul was hoping for a dynasty. And that dynasty is not going to happen. But Saul has a son named Jonathan. Jonathan is the heir apparent. Jonathan is the prince. Jonathan has everything to lose if David becomes king. You see, Saul is more concerned about the kingdom of Saul. Jonathan is more concerned about the kingdom of God. And if David is going to be king, then Jonathan determines that he will help and he will serve David. And that's what happens. Jonathan and David become best friends. Jonathan supports David's kingship, even though it will cost him the throne. And eventually, Israel goes into battle, and God, in his providence, keeps David out of that battle. And in that battle, Saul and Jonathan are killed. And what we hear is we hear something of the story. David becomes king over the southern tribes, Judah. But the northern tribe, where Saul has been, basically goes through civil war. You've got a number of sons and grandsons, and basically it's civil war, and David stays out of all of that. They are killing each other off. There's all kinds of intrigue and all kinds of nasty things, right? But in the meantime, when Jonathan and Saul were killed, the word came, so 2 Samuel 4, verse 4, when news of Saul and Jonathan's death reached Israel, Mephibosheth's nurse picked him up and fled. He's 5 years old. But as she's fleeing, she trips and she drops him. And when she drops him, he injures his legs, so he is crippled the rest of his life. So she's off in hiding because she's realizing that there's going to be some intrigue and he could be very much at risk. He's been in hiding ever since, fearful for his life. There's been ongoing war between David's house and Saul's house after Saul and Jonathan. And then you get some warfare that's going on. And basically you've got all the descendants of Saul fighting each other and then occasionally trying to take on David. And David's trying to stay out of some of this, right? So the question is, so where has Mephibosheth been during all of this? He's been in hiding. And he's in hiding because he knows his life is at risk. He's in danger. Why? Because he could be the heir. If the northern kingdom could get some independence. But you've got all of these powerful, nasty people going back and forth. And so Mephibosheth is literally, in a sense, off in a corner. His nurse understood the danger and went off and hit him. And eventually the northern thing gets settled. And it gets settled when they realize, look, all we're doing is killing each other off. And the northern tribes come to David and say, we want you to be king over us as well. So finally, David becomes king. David takes and conquers the city of Jebus, renames it Jerusalem. It's going to become the center of his nation. He begins to defeat and slaughter all of his enemies. Determines to build a temple. David's great desire. Here I am in a palace. God's living in a tent. Determines that he wants to build a temple, and Nathan says it's a great idea, and then God corrects him. So Nathan has to come back, but Nathan makes this wonderful promise. You actually won't build the building. Your son will do it. But God is going to make a great house for you. You are going to have a dynasty that is going to continue. And as a matter of fact, you are going to have a descendant who will be a priest who will sit upon the throne of the kingdom forever and ever. And so here's David. He's got peace all around him. He's got this great promise of an everlasting dynasty. But David still remembers Jonathan. And finally, he inquires and he says, is there any descendant of Jonathan anywhere that I could honor because of Jonathan? And the passage that you read said, well, let's send for Saul's servant Ziba. And Ziba comes and says, is there anybody left? Well, actually, Your Majesty, there is. Probably off in a hut somewhere. I mean, he has to give him the name of the guy and the name of the city, etc. And so what does David do? He learns about Mephibosheth, and he sends guards. Now imagine, you are Mephibosheth. You have been hiding off in a corner of the kingdom probably making sure you don't run around going, by the way, I'm Jonathan's son, I'm Saul's grandson. None of that. You're just hiding in a corner, just hoping you can survive. And one day your worst fear comes true. A couple of soldiers, maybe more than a couple, come riding up and they come to the door and they knock on the door and the door is open and they say, are you Mephibosheth? And with terror you go, yes. Come with us. The king wants to see you. And you figure you're headed to your execution. That is what is going to take place. You're expecting a sentence of death. And when you get there, rather than being told you are about to die, you are told, you are Jonathan's son. I want to honor you because of your father. And we sort of lose it in the translation. Do you realize that Saul, as the king of Israel, owned immense wealth? And David says, as a matter of fact, I'm going to take all the land that belonged to your father and all the land that belonged to your grandfather. This is huge territory. And it's now going to be yours. And Ziba, you're the servant, and you've got sons, and you've got slaves, and you are going to manage all of that property for him. And as for you, Mephibosheth, I'm having a special apartment made for you in the palace. And from now on, you eat at my table. And Mephibosheth says, Your Majesty, why would you do something like that for a dead dog like me? Why does he do it? Because of his father, Jonathan. And from that point on, Mephibosheth lives in Jerusalem. And he receives that blessing because of his father's commitment to the kingdom and his father's commitment to David. So what's the point of all of that for you and me? There's a couple of points. You see, you and I are the crippled and dead sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. And if the king acted in perfect righteousness, we would all be put to death. We would not have anything, any kind of a relationship. We would only be getting judgment. But because of the work of one like Jonathan, whose name is Jesus, you and I, instead of getting what we deserve, are invited into the kingdom and are invited to the table. In the first century, people with disabilities in Israel were not allowed into the temple. So that when Jesus comes along and heals a leper, the leper who's been kept out of the temple is now allowed to come to the temple. When he heals people who've been crippled, they've been kept out of the temple. They're now allowed to come to the temple. When he deals with a woman who has an issue of blood for 12 years, who's unclean and not been able to go into the temple, now she can go into the temple. What does that tell you about God's care for people with disabilities? What does that tell you about the ministry of Jesus? How much of it is reaching out? And he doesn't simply, in a crowd like this, go, y'all be healed. That he walks among them and he touches them and he transmits his power by his touch, demonstrating his care. See, Jesus, son of David, reached out and touched hundreds of hurting, disabled people, made them whole, and invited them into the kingdom to eat at his table. And you and I are the crippled and dead children of Adam and Eve who have no claim on the king, but through Jesus we are invited into the kingdom to eat at the table and to experience his blessing. He may or may not make you whole immediately. But one day, all disability will be removed. We will be given new resurrected bodies to inherit a new heavens and a new earth to feast together at the king's table. And my question for you is, when that day comes, will you merely be a fond memory of time that we spent on earth? Or will you, like Mephibosheth and countless others, Rejoice in the mercy and grace of the King, and come and enter the kingdom and be seated at the table to enjoy his fellowship. Let's pray. Father, remind us as we look at this story. It's a beautiful portrayal of Jesus' ancestor, David, who experienced grace and then demonstrates grace. Remind us that, like Mephibosheth, whether we're crippled or not, we're like dead dogs. We have nothing to offer. But you come and invite us to the table and offer us an inheritance because of what someone else has done on our behalf. God, let us not shut that invitation down. Let us not keep on walking away from it. But as Jesus is lifted up, let us be drawn to him as the one who comes to demonstrate all that the kingdom has to offer. Draw us to Christ. Help us to respond to the invitation to that great feast in anticipation of the day when all sorrow and disease and death and sickness and grief will be over. Lift up Jesus and draw us to him. We pray in his name. Amen.